Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Okay, tonight we're going to be in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 13 through 18. In my opinion, this is the most detailed description of the second coming of Christ available in the Scriptures. Does that surprise you? It's much more detailed than the whole book of Revelation, where only chapter 19 deals with the second coming. It's much more specific than the Gospels, like Mark 13, Matthew 24. And it really gives us some ground that we have some teachings we have nowhere else. And think, it comes in a church that had a problem. You kind of wish there were churches with more problems in Paul's day, because he would have spoken a lot more subjects we're interested in. Some of the stuff we would never get if some church didn't have a wacko problem. Like, the resurrection of the dead is dealt with in 1 Corinthians 15 because someone in the church denied the resurrection. That's the only reason Paul talked about it. And the same is true of the second coming. It's only dealt with because the church had a problem with it. And that problem was exemplified. Well, let's just wait till we get there, because I'm not sure we can find out exactly what it is. We can get some guidelines, maybe. Also, we do not want you to have any misunderstanding, brothers. Have you ever thought how important a comma is? Have you ever heard somebody read this and say, "We don't want you to be ignorant, brothers." We don't want you to be ignorant, comma, brothers. And now, Paul uses this quite often. I mean, I was surprised how often he used it. Listen to all this. Romans 1:13, 11:25, 1 Corinthians 10:1, 12:1, and 2 Corinthians 1:8. So he really used this little phrase a lot. It's kind of a way of saying, we want you to be fully informed about this. We want you to know. It's important that you know. That those who are falling asleep, now this falling asleep is, I think, related to three possible things. Two of them are controversial. One of them is probably true. Now, in Matthew 16:28, Jesus said, "Some of you standing here will see me coming in my glory." Now, some think this discussion is related to what did Jesus mean when he said some here won't die before they see this happening. And maybe this is talking about, maybe that was the problem. The other one is, in 1 Corinthians 11:30, Paul said that some had died because they took the Lord's Supper in an inappropriate manner. Maybe these people were afraid that their loved ones had done some sin that caused them to die, and they didn't know what the relation was. Maybe that's it. Even though those are two remote possibilities, I really think that what the deal is, that Paul's emphasis on the second coming, that somehow these folks have got the idea that you had to be alive to participate in the end time events. And they were really worried that some of their loved ones had died, and they weren't sure if they'd participate or not in those end time events. And so that's really what I think Paul is talking about. Now, this word falling asleep, we get the English word cemetery from that. How about that? I'm in 1 Thessalonians 4:13. Falling asleep is a present participle, and I think that's probably the best reading. It's an aleph, and B, A has a little different, but I think that's the best one. Now, what does this falling asleep mean? There have been many theories in our day and other days. Eusebius tells us about a group in Arabia that believed in soul sleep, which means when we die, we are in an unconscious condition until the second coming. Now, when it says falling asleep, does that mean we're unconscious? Is that why he's using that metaphor? Well, if you get your concordance out, it amazes me how many times in the Old Testament the word falling asleep is used and how often Jesus uses it. So it seems to be a common biblical metaphor for death. It has nothing to do about conscious or unconscious. It just means death. Let me give you a few verses. Genesis 47:30, 2 Samuel 7:12. And the kicker is 1 Kings 22:40. And in the New Testament, just to give you an idea how wide the scope of the use of sleeping, falling asleep for death is, Matthew 27:52, John 11:11-13, Acts 7:60, 13:36, 1 Corinthians 7:39, 15:18, 11:30, 2 Peter 3:4. So obviously, it's used throughout the New Testament as a
euphemism or metaphor of death. And that's what I think it is. It has nothing to do with conscious or unconscious. So to keep you from grieving over them, as do the rest who have no hope. Now, here is the problem.
This is why Paul wrote this paragraph, and probably the whole book, because the whole book is talking about the end time. I think there was a real misunderstanding. Now, that isn't so surprising to me, considering Paul was there 3 weeks. If you heard three sermons on the second coming, would you have it all in place? You know, how much could he teach them in 3 weeks? And so they really became concerned, and maybe they were grieving, as their pagan backgrounds indicated. Maybe they were really distressed over this. Probably Timothy brought him word about the problem over death of Christians in the church. And so this is the focal reason for the what follows. Now, the reason I say that,
we are so guilty sometimes of reading the Bible as if it were a theology book. Now, if God wanted us to have clear theology, unaffected by life, he would have written a book that says
salvation, Christian life, end times. And then he would have just listed doctrinally what he wants to know.
But most of the truths of the Bible are influenced by a local problem, a local situation, a question from somebody. And so it is, you have to see the backdrop to fully understand the discussion. And that's what we have here. Okay? Now, this idea of grieving is present tense. They will continue to grieve. Now, there's others who have no hope in Ephesians 2:12 that mentions about those who have no hope and speaks of everyone who doesn't know Christ. I have written down here something I picked up that I use in a funeral service sometime by Socrates. That's what he says. Oh, that there were some divine word upon which we could more securely and less perilously sail upon a stronger vessel. Do you catch the hopelessness in pagan world? Oh, it was just devastating. It's kind of like, what can a non-believer say to a non-believer at the death of someone? What do they say? I'm so sorry. I love you. What do you say? It happens to all of us. You know, and so he wanted him. He wanted a difference. I think
a word to our contemporary situation. I don't think Paul's saying don't grieve. I don't think he's saying you shouldn't cry at a Christian's funeral, because there's a real element of personal sorrow and loss, and I think that it's all right to express that grief. But I think there ought to be a different atmosphere at the funeral of a saint than the funeral of a lost person. I think there ought to be a hopefulness and a joy mixed with a sorrow at a Christian funeral. And there ought to, as a matter of fact, I love to do funerals because I get plumb evangelical at funerals. Either it works right there or it don't work anywhere, you know? And I consider it a real opportunity to talk to folks who are really thinking about eternal things right then. So I think it's a good word. And the Christians were doing that, and I've been to Christian funerals that I was embarrassed at the way what happened. And I think we need to think about that. I can't talk about this if one of your loved ones die. It'd be inappropriate. Wouldn't be the time for me to say it. But right now, you ought to think about planning your funeral where Jesus is lifted up and the victory over the grave is emphasized. Okay. Verse 14, for if we believe, this is that first class conditional sentence, so important. I guess I've told you a million times and probably you're tired of it. There are four classes of conditional sentences in Greek, all put if in English. First is assumed to be true. Fourth is the farthest removed from possibility. So this is the first, and I think it should be translated, since we do believe. He's not doubting if they're believers or not. He's saying, since we believe these things, it ought to impact our lives. And so this is that first class. This is where the devil says to Jesus in Matthew 4, if you are the Son of God, make these stones bread. And to English readers, the devil is doubting who Jesus is. Not at all. He's saying, since you are the Messiah, why don't you do this to win men? And you see how it changes the whole understanding? In Romans 8:31, where it says, if God is for us, who can be against us? You got to go around worrying if God's for you? No, it's since God is for us, who can be against us? That first class really, really makes a difference when it's found. Yeah, it's a, every English translation I know has if. Well, it's a conditional construction, but I think for English readers, since is so much better. Okay. Since we believe, that believe is present tense, it speaks of ongoing continuous action. Now, let's talk about believe just for a minute. It's so important. It's the verb pistuo and the noun pistis. It is used in the New Testament, not primarily of mental knowledge, though mental knowledge is important. You've got to know something or you can't commit to it. And it's used in a sense of emotions, but not primarily of emotions. We're emotional creatures, and every decision we make has some emotional element to it. It is primarily a volitional commitment to. The word believe can be is easily translated believe, faith, or trust. And so all those words are related etymologically, and that's important. If we believe that Jesus died and rose again, now there is the key of the gospel. I put, see 1 Corinthians 15:23 there. Then through Jesus, now that through Jesus is really a grammatical problem. And I don't know what to do with it. It either goes with the, what precedes it or what goes after it. Are we going to be brought back with God through him, or do we fall asleep through him? I don't know. I think both. I don't see the big problem except that we can't be dogmatic about where it grammatically links to. I think all of this is through Christ, but there's the key again. Christianity, take Christ out, you have nothing. God will bring back with him, implication being bring back with Jesus, those who have fallen asleep. Now, I want to talk briefly about the intermediate state of the dead, often called the disembodied state of the dead. And I want to give you a rapid moving account of what I think is happening biblically. Most of this I feel I could back up if I had longer, okay? Old Testament, when someone died, righteous and unrighteous went to the same place, Hades. In Hades, the rabbis begin to postulate, not revealed in Scripture, but they begin to postulate, if the righteous and the unrighteous went to the same place, there had to be a divider in there. They weren't all mixed together. There probably is division. And so the righteous part of Hades was called paradise, and the evil part of Hades was called Tartarus by the rabbis. Now, I think that's the way it rocked on even after the birth of Jesus. And I think up until Jesus died, when people died, they went to this holding place. I think Abraham's bosom is the holding place, Hades, not Gehenna. Gehenna is the word that Jesus used to describe hellfire or eternal judgment. In my opinion, nobody's in hell right now. It's empty. I think it's prepared, but it's empty. Hell has the connotation of judgment day after that, okay? So I don't think anybody's there right now. But when Jesus went back to heaven, Ephesians 4, 9 and 10 through there speak about that he ascended, also descended, and all that. I think when he went back to heaven, that Jesus cleaned out that righteous part of Hades. And therefore, 2 Corinthians 5:8 comes into play after the resurrection. And that is, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. That's something brand new. Before this, everybody went to this holding place. Now you say, well, Bob, is there any other way you can back that up? Remember the thief on the cross? Jesus said, today you'll be with me in paradise. Remember, Jesus didn't go to heaven for, I think, around 36 to 40 hours yet. So the place he had to go with him was not heaven, because he's not going there yet. He had to go to that righteous part of Hades, which was called paradise. Now that sounds really like I've got this thing locked in, but I don't, because Turkey Paul uses the word paradise in a different way. And a lot of this is rabbinical and not revelation. So I can't be dogmatic about it, but that to me seems to fit that sequence of where people went. Now, I believe that when we go to be the Lord, we do not have a body. Because this passage here is going to imply that when He brings us again with Him, those who are dead, they're going to receive their bodies right then. Now, whether it's going to be the same atoms or not, I don't know. But it seems to me we're with the Lord, but it's a disembodied state. It is bliss, but not complete bliss. Whether we know our loved ones at death, whether there's any reunion at death, I don't know. Biblically speaking, I'm uncertain. I think not, but I can't be dogmatic. I am certain there's going to be a reunion at Resurrection Day. Now, the reason it's so hard for us to talk about disembodied people is that that gets awful close to Greek thought about that your body has a soul, and at death your soul goes back and is absorbed in a deity, and what everybody wants is to get free of the body. That's Greek. Well, see, Christianity is just a stopgap measure from death to the resurrection. It's not an ultimate state. It's not a... Paul says, I don't want to be naked. I want to be clothed. So it's not something you long for and look forward to. Because Christianity is unique among all the religions of the world that we are going to have a bodily expression throughout eternity. My personal opinion is that we don't have a soul. We are a soul. And the body is the outward boundaries of our soul. That's why, to me, the classical passage is, and God breathed into His nostrils the breath of life, and He became a living soul. Now, you can't say much there because the same word used of soul is used for the cows a couple of chapters over. So it's not so much the soul there. It is the life-giving breath of God. But anyway, that's kind of where I think it's going. Yeah. Yes, I think the unbelievers go to Hades. And there's some punishment seemed to be involved and some very uncomfortableness based on the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. But it's not ultimate judgment or condemnation. I don't think that's going to happen until the last day, Matthew 25:31, the white throne judgment. Now, I personally see the judgment seat of Christ, which is, I think, 2 Corinthians 5:10, and the great white throne judgment, I see all that happening together. See, when he says he separates the sheep from the goats, implication is there's the believers there and there's the non-believers there. I think the whole thing is going to be dealt with in front of everybody. But we don't have enough to make real dogmatic statements. This is inferences picked from here and there, kind of related together, and so don't build too much on them. It's just my understanding. Now, let's see. Okay, verse 15. For the Lord's own authority, we say. Now, Paul, what he's saying here is, look, this is not my opinion. I didn't think this up. I didn't have a bad dream. This was directly given to me. Now, some think he's trying to quote someplace in the Gospels. Nowhere in the Gospels, in it appear. Some say, well, he's quoting an unwritten true words of Jesus. Possible. Maybe God told him when he was in Arabia. I don't know how he got it, but he's saying with authority, this is not my opinion. Okay. It's interesting, the verse before, notice that Jesus dies, but we sleep. How about that? You know, it's important he died and rose again. For us, it's like a sleep because of what he's done for us. Then it says that those of us who may be left behind and are still living when the Lord comes back. There's been much discussion here about, did Paul expect the Lord to come in his lifetime? Now, I want to give you, I am a dialectical teacher. And I think that confuses folks. Because all our life, we've heard people who make things black or white. They make things either or. They say, it's got to be this or it's got to be this. And you can't mix them together. Well, I'm a guy that feels much more comfortable with mixing them together. Because I think we only have one source of authority. And it's ambiguous. And so I feel more comfortable making two statements that seem contradictory than I do making one and leaving out part of the good news. So, did Paul expect the Lord to come back in his lifetime? Yes, I think he did. I think it's a good passage. I think Jesus expected himself to come back soon. You know, Jesus didn't know when he was coming back.
Now, you say, well, that means the Bible's wrong.
No, I really don't think it means the Bible's wrong. What I think is the deal, I think every generation of Christians needs the encouragement to live on a daily basis the expectation of the Lord's return. Part of our encouragement to live for Him is today may be the day. You know? And so I think that every generation has expected the Lord back in their lifetime, including the apostles. Now, that doesn't make them wrong. That makes them normal. Now, you catch the distinction? So you say, well, he didn't come back, so Paul was wrong. No, Paul was typical of every generation of Christians that has expected that same thing. And I really think that's what the deal is. But you can't be sure here, but it seems to imply that anyway. When the Lord comes back, we will have no advantage. Now, that is an extremely strong term. Some other translations will surely not have, surely not precede. It's a double negative in Greek. It's a strong, strong way of saying those who have died will not miss anything. Now, that is the question, remember? That's what these folks were worried about. Will my loved one who did believe but die, will he miss the events? Will he miss, what you were preaching about? And Paul's saying, quite the contrary. Not only will he participate, he's going to be there first. I used to have a Methodist music appreciation teacher, really a live wire. I used to love to kid him. So I told him, I've been studying my Bible, and I really think that the Methodists are going to be first in heaven. And boy, he smiled and said, why? I said, because the Bible clearly says the dead in Christ shall rise first. Boy, it just killed him. If you want to stick any denomination there you want to, feel free to take my duty. Well, oh, he croaked. I think I got a C in that chorus. Matter of fact, those of us who are left behind and are still alive when the Lord comes back will have no advantage at all over those who have fallen asleep. Okay? Verse 16. For the Lord Himself. Now notice, it's not somebody else. The Lord Himself. You might want to see John 5, 25 through 28. Very good backup reference. The Lord Himself, at the summons sound by the archangel's call and by the trumpet, by God's trumpet. Now, I want to go back to it because I don't like William's translation at all through here. I think the Lord Himself is who the command should come from. Now, grammatically, go either way, but I think the Lord's the one, and I think that's where John 5, 25 through 28 fits in. This word summons, command, is really an authoritative command. It's used in the military of commanding orders or commanding troops. And I think that John 5 passage is really important. Now, does yours have the archangel or an archangel? The? Mine does too, but it's horrendous. There is no article here. It should be an archangel. Now, let's talk about archangels just a minute. How many of you have heard all your life when Gabriel blows his horn? That's just common. That is unbiblical. Sorry, he took the wings off angels and took the horn out of Gabriel's hands. But anyway, the only archangel in the Bible, and it's only mentioned one time as far as called an archangel, and that's Michael. And that's in Jude chapter 9. Archangel is never mentioned anywhere in the Bible but Jude 9. Now, we also hear of Michael, though, from the book of Daniel, where he is the chief prince of the nation of Israel. Now, in Daniel 10:13... it says he is one of the chief princes. Now, because of Daniel 10:13, I think there probably are other archangels. Now, whether Gabriel's an archangel, we don't know. He appears to Mary. He's a messenger angel, primarily. He's never called an archangel. But since Daniel 10:13 is there, I probably do think there are several archangels, of which Michael is the particular angel of the people of God, be it Israel, the church, but whatever. And Paul seems to have a developed angelology. Now, some say, well, he's just being influenced by his rabbinical background. I'll buy that. But I also believe he was inspired by the Holy Spirit when he wrote the Bible. And so, I think some of that stuff was cut off and some, was intensified. Remember in that passage, that beautiful passage in the close of Romans 8, where it says, For I am persuaded neither death nor life, angels, principalities, powers. Now, in the book of Colossians, those same groups are mentioned seemingly as orders of angels, be they fallen or unfallen, is uncertain. But principalities, powers, angels, to me, are the angelic order of creation. Now, we know there's seraphim and there's cherubim and there's an archangel, there's regular angels. How it all fits together, the Bible just doesn't say. But I do think that each one of us has a guardian angel. I get that from Matthew 18. Now, for most of my life, I interpreted Matthew 18 as that children have guardian angels. But when I really went through there exegetically, I found it's not talking about children. It's all about new believers. So I really think all of us have one. How they're related to archangels, I don't know. But this is an archangel. Now, I expect an archangel to blow God's trumpet. I just don't expect him to give an authoritative command. Now, let me give you this God's trumpet. I think it's the Zophar. It's that ram's horn that is hollowed out. And if you ever try to blow one, though, you ever try to blow a cow horn, man, you've got to have some wind and you've got to know what you're doing. It just goes. Well, those Jews used that ram's horn for signals in battle and for calling feast days and special occasions. Now, all through the Old Testament, that trumpet is real, real important. Let me give you a few verses, if I could. Exodus 19:16, Isaiah 27:13, Joel 2:1, Zechariah 9:14, and also 1 Corinthians 15:52, where there's a kind of a general resurrection discussion there. The trumpet of the Lord's also mentioned. I've always wanted to preach on the second coming and have two trumpeters hiding in the baptistry. You talk about decisions. Boy, we can flood the place. Just a little trumpet blast, the appropriate time. But that'd be manipulative, wouldn't it? Notice it says, and he will come down from heaven. Now, people say, well, that means it's a three-storied universe and the Bible's wrong because we've been up there and God's not there. Well, I admit coming down may be somewhat inappropriate to modern science. But really, folks, the Bible is not meant to convey scientific, spatial, temporal theories. It is the language of description. God lives up there. You bury the dead in the ground, so the dead live down there. We live on the earth in between. It's just a way of speaking. It's like you saying, the dew fell. Dew doesn't fall. It condenses close to the ground. The temperature variation is greater. The sun didn't rise. The earth rotated. But you and I, in our sophisticated scientific age, still speak colloquially. And that's what the Bible's doing. So it says, come down from heaven. It just means that God's going to come from his realm into our realm. Now, if it's down, up, through, over, by, fourth dimensions, I don't know. But he's coming. And this same thing is mentioned in chapter 1, verse 10. And so you might want to see the parallel there, coming from heaven. And first of all, the dead in union with Christ will rise. Now, that means, I don't know, it's hard to think through, but let's see if we can do it. If that part of us, memory, person, personality, whatever, is with God, but our earthly body is here, then somehow we are going to be reunited with that. Now, if it's going to be our exact atoms, I don't know. If the dead that died in the ocean are going to come out of the ocean, and the dead in the graves are going to come out of the graves, I don't know. But it does seem to imply to me that we're going to pick up something of what we had materially here and it's going to be reunited with whatever it is with God in that twinkling of an eye, that last trumpet. So I think that it's saying what it's saying, and the dead are going to, it's going to happen to them first. We're going to realize that something has happened to dead corpses before something happens to us. They're going to rise up in the air before we do. Let me put it that way. Okay? Well, yeah, I think, in 1 Corinthians 15, it seems to say at the trumpet sound, at the twinkling of an eye, we're going to be changed. I think there is going to be a rapid succession of events. I think the twinkling of an eye is going to be his coming. It's going to be too late to pray. Lord, help me a sinner. It's going to be too fast for that. But once he appears, then I think there's going to be a sequential order, rapidly following of events. But that's just my perception of reading it. There's no way to know. But his coming is going to be as the lightning goes from the east to the west, as the thief comes in the night, as a woman's labor finally comes. All of that is those metaphors of the swiftness, the certainty, you know. No time to do anything then. Just bang. Okay, and then those of us who are still living will be caught up. Now, how many of you have heard of the doctrine of the rapture, right? You all heard it all your life. These bumper stickers that say, this vehicle will be unmanned at the rapture and all that, that's a particular dispensational premillennial system. That means there's going to be a secret rapture followed by a visible rapture. My personal theology says there's going to be one visible coming followed by a rapture. Now, the word rapture never appears in the Bible. The word caught up means to be snatched away. The Latin of that, R-A-P-I-O, is where we get the word rapture from. Now, let me see if I can tell you what I think about this. I think the Matthew passage about two in a field and two in the bed probably apply to here. I see the Lord coming down. Now, the word for air here is the lower atmosphere. It's not the higher atmosphere of the mountain. It's the lower atmosphere. So he's going to come real close to the earth. The dead in Christ are going to come out of the graves, be united with that invisible part that's with the Lord, and they're going to be in the clouds. I think the dead saints are going to be there first. I think the angels are going to be with him. Then I think we're going to be changed, and we're going to be caught up with them. Now, I think we're going to meet the Lord in the air for this theological reason. In Ephesians 2:2, Satan is called the prince and the power of the air, and the same word for the lower atmosphere is used. So I think the air, the atmosphere, is, biblically speaking, the realm of the evil spirits. And so I think we're going to meet the Lord right in the middle of the domain of the evil one and his, as a beautiful symbol of complete and total victory over evil. Now, my theology says we're coming right back down to a recreated earth. And by that, my end-time theology does not see us going to heaven at the second coming. The whole purpose is everything's moving from there to here. It's not we're moving there. Remember New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven as a bride adorned for a husband? Isaiah 11, the recreated earth where animals and children are there. The Bible begins in a Garden of Eden with God and man. Revelation 22, it ends in a garden with God and man. It seems to be an earthly setting. And so I expect a recreated, animal-inhabited fellowship with God on this planet, heaven. Now, whether that's only for a while or that's just part of it, I can't be certain. But I think that is an aspect of it. And so I see us meeting him in the air. Then I see us coming back down. Yes, my theology is post-tribulational, which I think the church will go through. All of that struggle, all of that tension. No, that's pre-tribulation. That implies a secret coming. I don't believe in a secret coming. I believe in one visible coming. So in my opinion, the church will go through that very hard time. All that tribulation and stress, we'll be through it. Some of us will die. Those who remain will happen then. Yeah. You mean after or before Armageddon? Debbie, I don't know. Armageddon doesn't fit real well in my system. And just like the two resurrections don't fit real well. So people say, well, if you know you got problems, why don't you chuck it? Well, they got more problems than I do. I don't think any system totally explains all those events. Whether it's the 1,000 years, then Satan's little season, and that's where Armageddon comes, I'm not sure. I have a personal bias in this area, and that is I don't think God has to beat a lost person over the head to prove he's God. You know, I don't think God needs to come into history and say, all right, get all your tanks together and I'll prove I'm God. To me, it's like playing cat and mouse. The eternal creator doesn't have to show his power in history for him to be God. And so I have somewhat of a problem of history having to be culminate in God winning a war. Does that make... it may be. I just really don't know. Notice through here there's no mention of it. Zilch. There's no mention in Matthew 24, Mark 13, you know. There's no mention in the Old Testament of it. The only mention of all that is those last few highly symbolic chapters of Revelation.
Yes.
Yes. In my opinion, the tribulation and the apostasy are coexistent. And that's why, personally, I would expect the Lord back in the morning. Because I'm waiting to see a couple of things happen. I want to see that falling away first, where all men lose love for their parents and everybody else, and Christians, those who are false, fall away from the church. And that it really comes a hard intensification of evil. And when I see that happening, and when I see the international scene begin to unify under one very powerful person, I think, boy, we are right at close. But I haven't seen that yet. And so I think there's a tension between some things must happen first and the any moment return of the Lord. And the way people have handled that tension is dispensational premillennialists have had a secret rapture and a visible rapture. That's how they've removed that tension. I just soon leave the tension and not know. Yes, that's the course. That's all the way through the churches in the Book of Revelation, the seven churches. I think I'd say the witness throughout the Bible, though, that those who hold out will receive. To me, another one of those dialectical tensions is justification. Well, security of the believer is only true when it's linked to the true saints will hold out to the end. You see, we have as Baptists have cut that doctrine off and made it just trust the Lord and whatever you do, it's all right. I don't believe that. I think when you truly trust the Lord, it's going to be a change in your life. And that change, that indwelling spirit is going to... Now, there's going to be periods of falling and sinning and all that, but that's going to hold out, and God's going to keep us till the end holding out. So I think it's a two-sided coin. Either part of the sides, if you take them apart, are unbiblical. So it's security and perseverance, just like it's predestination and free will.
Okay.
Intensification of the doctrine of humanism. Of course, we have to go a long way in our day. If we're most people that live today are not a student of history. They don't think about it. But we have to go a long way to beat the arrogance of the Renaissance. I mean, we're really going to have to move a long way toward man as the center to get back to where they were in the 19th century. The Enlightenment, the Renaissance, man was it then. And we've gotten a little bit away from that. It's almost like they put man's body on the stage. We've put man's mind, you know. And notice where it mentions, along with them, caught up along with them. Now, many people don't emphasize along with them, but that is what this whole passage is about. These people who lost their loved ones wanted to know, where are they? Will I know them? Will I be with them? So Paul adds emphatically, we're going to be caught up with them. They're going to be there. It's going to be the family group's going to be there. The church group is going to be there. We're going to be together there. Now that was the problem those Thessalonians were facing. Then it says, on the clouds. No article, on clouds. Now it is my personal belief that this represents the Shekinah cloud of glory in the Old Testament, which is the symbol of the presence of God. Throughout the Bible, clouds are always identified with deity. In the Psalms, he rides on the clouds of his chariot. Remember when the cloud came down Mount Sinai was the symbol of the presence of God. Remember when Isaiah saw the vision in Isaiah 6, saw the Lord high lifted up and then smoke filled the temple where he couldn't really see God? Smoke came down, the Shekinah cloud, in Solomon's dedication of the temple. Now, in Daniel 7:13, very important, the Son of Man, which means human being, came riding before the Ancient of Days on the clouds of heaven. So here we have a human being. That's what Son of Man means, human. But he's riding on the transportation of deity, the clouds of heaven. Well, I think Jesus picked that term, Son of Man, because it has a human aspect and a divine aspect. Well, then the New Testament, remember where Jesus was lifted up from the earth? What caught him? He was lifted up into the clouds. It's amazing how many times the Bible, Jesus' return is spoken of as him coming back in the clouds. Now, some say it means a cloud of witnesses. No, it doesn't. It just means that cloud symbolizing the presence of God. And so the clouds are very important here. Let me give you a few verses. Daniel 7:13, Matthew 24:30, Matthew 26:64, Acts 1:9-11, Revelation 1:7. Okay? In the air, that's that Ephesians 2:2. That's the lower part of the atmosphere, the reign of the evil one, to meet the Lord, and so we shall be with the Lord forever. Now, Paul can't say anything beyond that. You know, for Paul to be absent from the body, to be present with the Lord, he would have died and lived. When Paul has said we're going to be with the Lord, he has said everything that his theology can say about the greatness of the event. There is nothing beyond that to say. That's the ultimate, for us to be with him. No more superlatives, no more events. You can't get any better than that. That's just as good as it can get. And then he says, so continue encouraging one another with this truth. Notice, in the midst of a doctrinal section, Pastor Paul comes through. This is not a doctrine for us to sit down and get our charts out and say, boy, I'm right and you're right and I got my club and you got your proof text. The truth of the second coming is meant as a pastoral aid in encouraging one another at the death of loved ones and Christians. The second coming should not be a divisive issue. It should be a comforting issue among believers. And unfortunately, the pride that's rampant in the world is the pride that's rampant in the church. When we get a system down, we're committed to that booger. I've often thought, you put a Christian in a room with the Bible, say, give me what you think the second coming's about. He would never come up with all these systems. Never, ever, never. You know, and that tells me probably we have overkilled this area. I remember talking to a classical Greek teacher one time. He said, you guys are the pits. You know, you make this little article mean this, and you make this pronoun mean that, and you make this noun mean that. I said, you can't add all that into those words. It'd be kind of like us going back to the etymology of every English word and seeing where it came from Anglo-Saxonism and how it was used in the Middle Ages. Well, that's what we tend to do to the Bible. We just strain it so much and make it say so much more than it really can say. I think the obvious surface meaning that would have impacted the people that Jesus spoke to or Paul spoke to, that they would have just understood naturally, is the major thrust of the Bible. Not all this hidden numbers and this word has so many letters and you add them all up, it means this and this pronoun. That's a bunch of hooey, really. So yes. Well, yes, they're really big on that. And some of that's in the Bible. The name 666 is that same kind of mindset that you can get somebody's name by adding up the numbers. And it's really Jewish Kabbalah, which is getting popular again, which is that mystical understanding of names and numbers. Yeah. Questions or comments? I know it's difficult, and we could all spend 2 hours on our own opinions. But I'd be happy to visit with a while about this. Notice I said a while. Well, Monaco?
I think it's very important that every generation expects a second coming. Because whether it comes or not, it really doesn't matter because at death, that's the last chance that we have.
Yeah, I told somebody I'm not really praying for the Lord to come back. Because I really hadn't done a real good job at witnessing to some of my loved ones and friends. And when he comes back, it's great for me, but it's all over for them. So I heard a guy preach one time on the second coming. Am I for it or against it? That really shocked me. And then when I heard what he said, I thought, I'm not sure I'm really wanting to come today either. It's going to be great for me, but oh, Lord. I think that really is important.
I really do. Somebody else? Go ahead. Burnt with a fervent heat. Oh, pray for the coming. Yeah. It also says pray in hastening. That's basically the verse that post-millennialism picks up to say that we bring in the kingdom by our actions. Well, I think there's some truth to that. I think there are some actions of man that, you know, the preaching the gospel to all nations. I think that's up to us. And we need to get on with it. But I have real problem that our actions or our prayers are going to facilitate or hold back the coming. When Jesus prays in Matthew 6:10, for thy kingdom come, what he's praying for is the second coming. Whether all Israel will be saved, now my theology would put it before his coming. But some would put it in another, you know, event in the millennium or sometime like that. I personally believe that the fullness of the Gentiles must occur. That's Romans 11, around 25. And that all Israel, whatever that means, will turn to the Lord. One of the signs of the end that I'm expecting is a repentant spiritual Israel. And she's not that today. She is a nationalistic, you know, nation, but she's not repentant. So, yeah, I would see that as something that I want to see. But I'm not sure that, I'm not positive that happens pre-second coming or post. You know, Zechariah says they'll see whom they have pierced and mourned. And so maybe it's going to happen instantaneously with. They will see him coming and realize. And I just don't know, Dad.